in Timber Sycamore, actually, which was launched by the CIA, the help of the UK and some regional intelligence agencies back in 2012, its goal to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Now, the operation trained and gave weapons and money to thousands of so-called rebel opposition in Syria. So if we look at what has happened since 2012, I mean, at least 500,000 Syrians were killed, at least 10 million displaced. How responsible would you say the United States is for what took place then and what is happening right now?
Is that for me?
No, it's that's for
life. Directly responsible for the slaughter. And obviously, you know, you brought out the proof immediately in your question. But it's important right now to look at what's happening currently, and that is that the empire ruled from D.C. with its local vassals, Turkey and the others like the Zionist colony, have reactivated these death squads, the Wahhabi Contras, in the Idlib region because they believe that they have weakened the other components of the Axis of Resistance, namely Hezbollah, who at in the last confrontation around Aleppo was key in the liberation of the region of Aleppo and the Battle of Saraqib against the Turkish military directly, where that Astana peace and ceasefire agreement was signed because of that. So now the Axis of Resistance looks weak to the enemies, and this is why they attacked in this region. And currently, as we see, the Iraqi popular mobilization units are having to fill the role that Hezbollah did in the last confrontation there. And I would say all these attacks that we are seeing, whether it's in Lebanon or in Syria, you know, we know our enemy is vicious, is criminal, and the leadership of the Axis of Resistance needs to change their track and go on the offensive to make sure that the long-term plans that the Zionists and the Empire have laid out don't actually come to fruition. Sitting down in a defensive manner, as we have seen over the last 14 months, the Axis of Resistance, for the most part, was on the defensive and showing solidarity fronts with Palestine, have led that posture has led to the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Sheikh Haniyeh, and Yahya Sinwar, and the multitude of generals and military leaders on all the fronts. This is not a winning formula. The Axis of Resistance should go on the offensive right
now.
What
does that mean, Life? Let's open up what you're saying a little bit when you're saying that the Axis of Resistance have been more in a defensive mode and should go in an offensive mode. So what are you saying? What should be done in your perspective?
What should have been done a while ago, even 6 months ago, was to the destruction of Israeli air capabilities and an invasion liberation of the Golan Heights and the north of Palestine. If the HDS ragtag militia death squad can roll into Aleppo within 2 days, the forces of the Axis of Resistance can roll into Jerusalem in 2 days also. The problem here is that if we continue on this defensive posture and attempt to negotiate with Turkey or sway them or sway some of the Arab monarchies in the Gulf to change reality or play this diplomatic game, we may see attacks directly right now to assassinate President Assad, or Abdelmalek al-Houthi, Sayyid Abdelmalek al-Houthi of Yemen, or even the Ayatollah in Iran. This defensive posture and waiting for this so-called ceasefire in Lebanon for 60 days, that brings Trump into power at the end of those 60 days, and he's coming to attack Iran. If we sit down and wait for them to attack Iran, we will be regretting it.
Okay. All right. Well, John, what about this? I mean, let's talk about what Vlad said, because on the one hand, as they say, hindsight is 2020. But the reality is that we know from the very beginning the Zionist regime has wanted the United States to get more directly involved and to bring Iran more directly involved and to basically weaken the part of the resistance that was actually trying to, as far as giving weapons and support. I mean, your take on where we are right now, because if we look at what is happening in Syria, do you think that the resistance front in general needs to be more aggressive right now? We know just probably like an hour ago, we do know that Hezbollah has responded to some of the Israeli basically not following up on the ceasefire, and Hezbollah did respond. But your thoughts on what needs to be done at this point in time?
Well, I take somewhat of a little bit more of a perspective view here. I think Trump is himself in a conundrum, and it's as your other commentator mentioned today, he's 2 months away, less than 2 months now, before he becomes president. And Trump has sold himself to the public as being the anti-war president. But he sold himself to the Israel lobby as being their war president. So Trump is going to have to make a decision of whether he puts the Israel lobby before America or if he puts America before the Israel lobby. And that's going to come very, very quickly in late January and early February. I'm hoping, as a person who's covered as a military correspondent for many years, I've covered conflicts, and I think that there is a chance that if the right people speak to Trump, he can be persuaded not to fall victim to the Israel lobby and not to be their paid boxer against their enemies. That's about that. As for the situation in Syria, the fact is that these are American-backed, and when I say American, I don't mean the people of America, and far from it. The people of America have no idea what is being done in their name by the CIA, the NSA, and the other organizations that run the secret government. But there is an American military-industrial complex which makes billions and trillions of dollars by fostering wars like this. And so what has to be done on the part of the Syrian government and on the part of the axis of resistance is that they need to, as your other commentator mentioned, they need to devastatingly crush these guerrilla agents of the deep state of the United States. They need to destroy them. And I think that there's a good possibility that they might be able to seek Russian assistance in that mission, because Russia has been building up the defenses against the warmonger Americans for the better part of a decade, and now has superior weapons in every category. If it turns out that the Syrian government needs assistance in turning back these terror agents of the deep state, I would suggest that Russia should give that assistance, and it should be quickly mopped up, and Syria should be secured. Because okay, Syria, if it's put under pressure, puts additional pressure on the rest of the region, including Iran.
Right. Of course, Russia has been involved in some airstrikes, but we'll see exactly what else that entails. Leith, in 2016, because you talked about Donald Trump coming to power, I want to go back to 2016, because then presidential candidate Trump accused Barack Obama, who was president, of actually founding ISIS or Daesh in Syria, and that needed to stop. I mean, you talked about him coming to power and perhaps making it worse. How likely is it what John said, that perhaps he can go back to that perspective he had in 2016 and that he said we need not to be involved in Syria?
Well, look, that would entail me believing that of the fairy tale of democracy. Trump is just a sock puppet, just as Biden is, and they just play this theatrics for the nullification and dullification of the Western audience, the American citizens. The truth of the matter, neither of them actually rule this empire, and the Zionists are part of those who actually rule the empire. It's impossible to decouple right now somebody like Trump from the Zionists, that would be even more foolish than the attempt to sway Erdogan away from NATO towards BRIC. That's all. Both of those are a fool's errand. It's easier to chop off the tail of a dog than imagine it ever becoming straight or stopping to wag. So this is realism, not utopia that we're talking about. And we are in the midst of a war. Look, the American bases in Iraq and Syria must come under attack right now. If they don't come into under attack and the Americans are not weakened in the region when Trump comes in, he is going to be slowing down the war in Ukraine and launching a major attack on all of the axis of resistance, including Iran. And it's not because it's Trump. This is the original American plan for the new American century with Bush. The idea was to destroy all the republics that escaped colonialism in the Arabic and Muslim world, and then, after that, clearing the playing board from the smaller pieces, go directly into confrontation with Russia and China. And what we saw is because the Arabic peoples, the Muslim peoples of the region, the Axis of Resistance, fought the Americans over every inch and drew them into a quagmire of quicksand, the Americans were stuck here and couldn't attack Russia or China. And in the meanwhile, in those 30 almost years, China became the biggest economy in the world, and Russia revived its military capabilities. And that's why the Americans rushed into a war in Ukraine without finishing the job here. And as we see right now, the deep state in the United States is trying to gear up back again to try to finish off the major opponent that it has in Western Asia here, the Axis of Resistance, mm-hmm. before going back to attacking Russia and China.
Okay. Well, John, what does it mean that, on the one hand, attack theory terrorists Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, are labeled a terrorist group by the U.S., but on the other hand, Washington is using them to sow chaos in Syria?
Well, they have to maintain this cloak of deniability. They never admitted setting up Al-Qaeda. They never admitted setting up ISIS. They never admitted providing them with weapons. They mysteriously buried bin Laden at sea, so there's never been any body found. It's like a fairy tale, as my fellow commentator has said here. And actually, there is a large number of people in Washington who know what's going on, but they're afraid for their jobs. I worked as a management consultant and lobbyist in Washington during the worst era of the Bush regime, and I can tell you that there are many people who know what the truth is, but there are very few people who have the guts to share it.
So what does it mean, John? I mean, at the end of the day, because the people of the region, West Asia, are the ones suffering. The Americans, those who are in Washington, they know the truth, but they're afraid of losing their jobs, so they won't stand up against the government. In the meantime, people in West Asia and other parts of the world to lose their lives from this industrial military complex. So go ahead.
Unfortunately, there's a world of difference in the perspective of the American people who are the victims of the lying mainstream media. They are not seeing any pictures of what these terrorists are doing, these terror agents are doing. They are only told that Syria is bad, Iraq is bad, Iran is bad, and that's all they need, because the average American is just basically getting by, trying to pay their credit card bills, and they believe whatever lying talking head on CNN or CBS or MSNBC tell them.
Right.
There
right.
is a world change necessary, and the people of America do not know what is going on, and I sincerely hope that some of them somehow find their way to alternative news sources like Press TV that can tell them that what they're being told is a lie, and that it's their responsibility to find out what the truth is.
Yeah.
Because there's, as your other commentator said earlier, there is no democracy in America. And I live here in the so-called democracy of Canada, where I know for a fact that we're ruled by a clique that is self-perpetuating. So this has to be shared with the public.
Okay. Well, Lyth, looking at the Syrian situation and the lack of stability or a weakened Syria, tell me about Turkey's role. How does Turkey benefit from this type of turmoil taking place inside of Syria?
Is this for me?
No, it's for Lyth.
Well, number one is the getting, you know, being in favor in the favor of the empire, and we saw Turkey loot all the industrial base of Syria that was in the regions around Aleppo, and the Syrian industries, specifically clothing and you know, small electronics and so forth, were the biggest competitor for Turkish industries in the region, and we have all the olive oil and all the harvest of Idlib and North Aleppo, that is some of the most fertile regions in the area. So the Turks have gained a lot, and now, as we see, they have control over Aleppo, the second or third oldest city, continuous inhabited city in the world. They're flying the Ottoman Turkish flag on the top of the citadel of Aleppo. These are all, you know, bringing back the idea of Turkish Ottoman rule over the area. We see Turkey then now being given more role in destabilizing Central Asian countries and the, you know, Turkic nations, including the Uyghur in China. Turkey benefits a lot from being such a venomous state ruled by Erdogan in the region. And so what is the axis of resistance and or Russia? What can we offer Turkey that can sway them away from such, you know, gifts from the empire? This is why it's clear that it's a fool's errand to try to change Turkey without, you know, an actual revolution there. Even remember the day when Russia and Iran saved Erdogan from the coup that the United States was organizing against him. They should have probably let him fall. There's nothing redeemable about Erdogan. And look at how the Turkish state maintained all the oil and supplies to the war machine of Israel without the continued deliveries of Azerbaijani oil and looted Syrian and Iraqi oil that was smuggled through Turkey to the Zionist colony. The Israeli war machine would have come to a halt.
Right.
They couldn't be operating their machineries.
Okay. Well, John, today the U.S., U.K., France, and Germany called for a de-escalation in Syria. It is mind-boggling to hear this when these are the parties which have sponsored and supported the terrorists to begin with this destabilization project of Syria since 2012. I mean, your thoughts on this hypocrisy. And once again, this is the image, of course, that's going to be shown to, as you said, mainstream media throughout the world, that these entities are actually calling for de-escalation in Syria.
Well, I think those of us who have experience in these matters know that these are just bald-faced lies. Specifically in the case of America's military colonies in Europe, Germany, England, and France, they do what they're told. It's a sad thing to have to admit, but they just do what they're told. They don't have an option. Germany is whining a little bit about being on the front lines in Ukraine, but when it comes to Turkey, they're far enough away from the situation that they're going to do what they're told, at least until Biden is out of office. I really think that your other commentator and I are on the exact same line about the so-called utopia and the fake democracy in America, but I haven't yet given up hope. I do think that the American leadership will think about their own interests first. And when caused to make a choice, when forced to make a choice of being the, as you said it, sock puppet of the Israel lobby, I think there's a chance that Donald Trump can be swayed. But we have to get to Donald Trump, and we have to make it worth his while to do so.
Okay.
And we've seen that already happen with Elon Musk, who made it worth his own while to move from being a Democrat to being a Republican. We need to flip things head for tails in Washington
okay.
if we don't want
Stay
to
with
World
me, John.
War III.
Lyeth, final comments. Where do you see this situation going in Syria?
I hope I am correct in assessing that it seems like the Russian Air Force and Russian military has awakened to the plots of Erdogan, and as we see also, Iran is responding by sending all these military advisors that were part of the liberation of Aleppo last time, and the thousands of Iraqi popular mobilization units that have crossed already the border to come to the defense of Aleppo and Hama. So I hope that we will be seeing the crushing defeat of these Wahhabi death squads, and this time nobody should be trying to stop the Syrian military from completely liberating Idlib and
okay.
Aleppo. This should be the target, and it should be done as fast as possible
okay.
before
on
the
that
coming
note, I'm
of
so sorry,
Trump,
I have to interrupt
so that
you,
these
but
allied
we
forces
are
and the
out
acts
of
of resistance
time. Appreciate
are.
Both of you being with me. John Busnage, journalist out of Canada, Lyeth Maarouf, activist and political commentator out of Lebanon. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear listeners, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents and commentaries of chapter Qasas, the 28th chapter of the Holy Quran. Dear listeners, as you were with us, we were discussing the story of Prophet Moses in the beginning verses of Surah Qasas. We have reached the 5th and 6th verses of this chapter. Now let's listen to these verses.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَنُرِيدُ أَن نَّمُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنَجْعَلَهُمْ أَئِمَّةً ونجعلهم أئمة ونجعلهم الوارثين.
And we wanted to confer favor upon those who were oppressed in the land, and make them leaders and make them inheritors.
ونمكن لهم في الأرض ونري فرعون وهامان وجنودهما منهم ما كانوا يحذرون.
And establish them in the land and show Pharaoh and his minister Haman and their soldiers through them that which they had feared.
So, in the previous episodes, we have discussed in details about the different words and terminologies applied in these verses, what kinds of traditions related therein, and also the fact that the term استضعاف, نريد أن نمن على الذين استضعفوا في الأرض, has different meanings and connotations, but the most important one, and the one that is actually intended in the very core meaning of this word, is the fact that there are some people who are oppressed. Istadafa means that somebody actually tried to make the other side weak by tyranny. And the other side is now mustadaf, which means that the other side, the powerful side, has tried to take power from him. The other side has tried to seek actually la'af and weakness in this side. So those are the mustadaf. Now, and we said in the previous episode that we have different kinds of mustadaf. We have actually cultural mustadaf. We have economic mustadaf. We have ethical mustadaf, political mustadaf, even ideological mustadaf. And all of these people are, in the meaning and the sense of the meaning of the word, are mustadafin. In one place, the Holy Quran invites the believers to struggle in the way of Allah and helping the faithful oppressed ones. So we actually said in the previous episode that the Holy Quran in 5 occurrences has referred to the oppressed, and the words are about the believers who were under the pressure of the oppressors. Now, in one place, the Holy Quran uses this kind of invitation, and it says, "And what has happened to you that you shall not fight in the way of Allah, and for the weak among them, men, women, and children, who say, 'O Lord, take us out of this town whose people are oppressors, and appoint for us from your guardian, and appoint for us from your helper.'" So, only in one instance, the Holy Quran speaks about the ones who are unjust and cooperate with disbelievers while they claim that they are oppressed. But the Holy Quran negates their claim. The Holy Quran says, "In what state were you?" They replied, "We were oppressed in the land." The angels were say, "Was not Allah's land vast so that you could have migrated therein? But since they did not so, their abide is hell." So the Holy Quran, however, has supported the oppressed always, everywhere, and it has mentioned them fairly and has considered them the under pressure believers who are strugglers, who are in the grace of the Almighty Allah. So that's the true meaning of mustadaf. Mustadaf is not just the one who does not have any kind of power, any kind of strength. No, mustadaf is the one who is actually strengthening, who is trying to do something. At least he shouts, he has the potential to shout, but the final destination is victory, as the Almighty Allah has promised. So, dear listeners, now that we have discussed these two verses, we have come to a conclusion. It was not only Pharaoh who slaughtered the people, he slaughtered the men of the children of Israel. He kept their women alive to be maid servants. He tried to do this for the captivity of the children of Israel. But it was not just Pharaoh, that's the point. The point is, All the tyrants of history have used to do like that. All the tyrants throughout the history have caused the active powers to be useless by any mean they could. So, wherever they could not break the men, they broke their manliness. They stopped the spirit of bravery. They stopped the spirit of courage and faith in them. What? How? By different means, by spreading means of corruption, narcotic materials, expansion of indecency, by sexual deviations, by the development of liquor and gambling, by any kind of unsafe amusement possible. Why? Because they could continue their self-interest government with the peace of mind. But the divine prophets, specifically the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, what he tried to do was that he tried to awaken the inactive powers of the young people. So he taught manliness to women. He led them in the order and row of men against the oppressors. And the evidences of these programs are so manifest throughout the history, in the past, and nowadays even, in different Islamic countries, and there is no need of mentioning them here. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune in to IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
At Sana University, a sense of defiance and determination filled the air. Hundreds of students, graduates of the Al-Aqsa Flood military courses, marched in formation, demonstrating their readiness to join Yemen's armed forces.
We, the students of Sana'a University, have rallied today in response to the leader's call. May God protect him, and in solidarity with the oppressed people in Palestine and Lebanon and around the world. As the voice of freedom, we declare our readiness to fight this enemy until the day of judgment, generation after generation. We will not yield, standing firm like the mountains.
The parade was not just a display of discipline, but a statement of intent. It emphasized Yemen's ongoing mobilization and what it describes as the struggle against the United States and its allies, including Britain and Israel. Participants reaffirmed their commitment to defending the oppressed people of Gaza, who are enduring what they described a brutal Israeli war backed by the United States and Britain.
From Sana'a University, we send a message to the whole world, and to the forces of evil, America, Britain, and Israel, that all members of Sana'a University, employees, academics, and students, are ready to confront the enemies and wherever the axis of resistance requires. We are prepared to sacrifice and will not abandon Palestine at any cost.
This event comes amidst rising tensions in the region. The Yemeni army has vowed to intensify operations against the U.S. Navy and Israeli-occupied territories, framing these moves as retaliation for America's complicity in Israel's genocide in Gaza.
In Yemen, this parade is a powerful demonstration of both military strength and ideological resolve, highlighting Yemen's growing significance in regional conflicts. Amid the ongoing Israeli genocide war on Gaza, Yemen's message is clear. It is ready to intensify its resistance against the occupying regime. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
President Yoon Suk-yeol decreed martial law late Tuesday, citing anti-state moves and threats aimed at undermining his government's authority.
I hereby declare an emergency martial law in order to defend the Free Republic of Korea from the threat of North Korean communist forces and to eradicate the shameless pro-North anti-state forces that are depriving our people of their freedom and happiness.
Lawmakers then raced to the National Assembly, avoided forces deployed to implement martial law, and voted to overrule the president. Hours later, Yoon accepted the ruling lifting martial law. Democratic Party leaders, however, warned the political crisis is not over yet.
Yoon won't hesitate to cause great destruction for small benefits. There is a high possibility of him endangering people's lives by provoking North Korea, causing chaos near the military demarcation line, and in the end, causing an armed clash. Dear citizens, you have to fight by our side.
President Yoon's shock bid has left South Koreans anxious about the fallout from the political instability in the country. Some have called his moves to consolidate power a treasonous coup attempt.
Yoon Suk-yeol was under immense pressure. His popularity rate was really low, and there were even corruption allegations against his wife. So I think that he probably acted out of desperation. He tried to distract the attention towards a different topic, and I think that's why he did it. And probably he thought he would survive it, but to be honest, I think his move has really backfired.
Six progressive parties Wednesday submitted a proposal to impeach President Yoon. And if a two-thirds majority of lawmakers pass that measure, Yoon could face immediate suspension from office. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's political gambit seems to have failed quite dramatically. For many, now the debate is only how long he will remain the president before resigning or being forced from office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
They too deserve an end to the fighting.
With less than 2 months before he leaves office, United States President Joe Biden is expected to flood Ukraine with over $7 billion in more weapons.
President Biden directed me to oversee a massive surge in the military equipment that we are delivering to Ukraine so that we have spent every dollar that Congress has appropriated to us.
In a move denounced by human rights groups, the first tranche of the largest weapons package in 7 months includes landmines, which were banned in a treaty signed in 1997 by over 160 nations, including Ukraine. Washington has crossed so many of their own alleged red lines that the Biden administration was forced to clarify that the latest shipment will not hand Kiev nuclear weapons.
It seems as though Biden feels emboldened and that since the election is over, there's really no check on his power. So he's using this lame duck moment to continually add fire to the flames in Ukraine now with the unrestrained use of landmines, the use of long-range missiles deep into Russia, bringing the escalation ladder to a pitch that we haven't seen yet, and you know we always wish that we had never had to see.
Analysts say that Biden wants to ship in as many weapons as possible before Donald Trump comes into office in January, as he has been a vocal critic of the vast military aid for Kiev.
Trump has made belligerent threats to Russia, but also promised to end the conflict on his first day in office, making the incoming administration's foreign policy difficult to guess. What the latest announcement appears to make certain is that Biden's legacy will be one of exacerbating the bloody conflict between Russia and Ukraine instead of furthering diplomacy.
I think that with all of this, we have to just remember that how it started was Blinken and Biden admitted essentially that they knew that it would lead to this level of confrontation and chose to keep saying, you know, we're not coming to the table, we're not negotiating. You know, it's similar to Rumsfeld and Cheney saying we don't negotiate with terrorists, but now they don't even negotiate with sovereign states. So it's madness.
Since February 2022, Biden has sent some $185 billion to Ukraine. Despite the vast weapons transfers and the marshaling of NATO, Biden is leaving office with Russia stronger than ever on the battlefield and with unprecedented demands, both domestically and abroad, to push Kiev to peace talks. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Committee for Supporting the Arab People in Lebanon and Palestine. A speech festival highlighted the urgency of confronting the U.S.-Israeli aggressions and addressed the ongoing violations in Gaza and Lebanon. Speakers underscored the critical need to support the resistance as the only means of countering the U.S.-Israeli atrocities.
This festival is organized by the Popular Committee in support of the Palestinian and Lebanese people. Its aims are twofold. First, to celebrate the victory of the Lebanese resistance in thwarting the plans of the Israeli regime. And second, to reaffirm our unwavering support for and solidarity with the Palestinian people and the resistance in Gaza as grassroots movements.
The speakers underscored that through steadfastness and resilience, the U.S.-Israeli schemes can be nullified. They commended the resilience of the resistance fighters in Gaza and Lebanon, while condemning Israeli violations and calling out a global silence on the ongoing genocide in Palestine and aggression against Lebanon.
The heroic Palestinian and Lebanese resistance movements have succeeded in halting their plans for a new West Asia and thwarted Netanyahu's plans, who has long sought to reshape the region and redraw its borders. This was stated in his recent speech before the United Nations. We believe that the steadfastness of the Palestinian people and their courageous resistance over more than 14 months of genocide in Gaza, coupled with the support from the Lebanese resistance for the Palestinian cause, has effectively dismantled all Israeli schemes in the region.
We are here at the invitation of the Popular Committee to support the resistance and the resilience of the Palestinian and Lebanese people in the face of this unjust aggression. We strongly believe that words, actions, and grassroots movements are vital to overcoming this struggle. We are here to keep this cause alive until the liberation of Palestine and the triumph of the resistance.
The participants called on Arab countries to reconsider their relations with Israel, revoke their agreements with the regime, and continue supporting the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the resilience of the Palestinian people in Gaza. Participants emphasized that the events in Gaza and Lebanon are not isolated incidents, but part of a broader U.S.-Israeli strategy. They asserted that resistance is the only effective way to confront this agenda. Zeid Agarbe, Amman.
The actions of the leader of a Franco-Israeli organization blocking trucks carrying humanitarian aid for the besieged civilians in Gaza have been widely condemned. Nili Nauri Kupfer, who heads up the Israel Is Forever Association, is one individual specifically named in the civil suit for complicity in genocide.
They are putting on internet videos showing how they're starving the population in Gaza. So because they are also French, we have the possibility to sue them, and we put a complaint against them.
Those people are an accomplice to the genocidal Israeli behavior towards the population of Gaza.
The NGO said it was crucial that those who supported these actions, including French nationals, be held accountable for their roles. At a rally this weekend, members of the Euro-Palestine NGO also expressed satisfaction at the arrest warrants issued by international justice against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Both men are accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. However, some observers say that any legal proceedings will likely prove purely symbolic.
Not only Netanyahu and Gallant must be afraid if they visit a number of countries who are part of the International Criminal Court, but also everybody who is complicit with them can be sued. And they must, this is a very important warning. It's not just symbolic.
Justice in such cases moves notoriously slowly.
As lawyers prepare for a court case that may be months away, the relentless destruction of civilians and the infrastructure in Gaza continues, with no sign of a ceasefire in sight. Peter Hume, Paris.
The southern Iranian island of Kish has played host to a grand conference celebrating Iran's National Navy Day, a day to honor the Navy's martyrs and commend its achievements, including the full construction of advanced vessels like the Jamaran and Denov frigates. The event also underscored Iran's diplomatic ties with regional nations, with top military and diplomatic officials in attendance, including representatives from Russia and Oman, along with military attaches from 24 other countries. Addressing the audience, Commander of the Iranian Navy, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, emphasized the strategic role of the Persian Gulf as a hub for peace and friendship.
Naval diplomacy is one of the key responsibilities of naval forces worldwide. We take pride in prioritizing the development of maritime diplomacy and fostering cooperation with the naval forces of friendly, neighboring, and brotherly nations, leaving no effort spared in this pursuit.
The Navy Chief also emphasized playing an active role in joint regional naval exercises, educational exchanges, operational collaborations, maritime conferences, and even sports competitions. These efforts, as he explained, have been pivotal in fostering mutual understanding and regional stability, a view echoed by Peter Rosenberg, the representative of foreign military attaches in Iran.
It is a diplomacy and dialogue which is the most important to communicate with another regional players, not weapons, but only diplomacy. And diplomacy can assure that you can have your interest assured, but diplomacy must be supported by the strong army and navy. And this is Iranian Navy which is doing this.
In line with these viewpoints, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi also underscored the strong collaboration between Iran's diplomatic and military institutions. He praised the synergy between the country's armed forces and its diplomats as a cornerstone of Iran's strategic resilience.
The armed forces and diplomats complement each other on the international stage, with diplomats relying on field power as their backbone, at the forefront of which are the armed forces. In the highly volatile conditions of the region, Iran's diplomacy operates in full coordination with its armed forces, and this synergy has demonstrated its benefits effectively so far.
That is why this year, National Navy Day served as an opportunity to showcase Iran's naval strength with a fleet of missile boats, frigates, and submarines, all indigenously built. The display symbolized not just technical advancement, but also Iran's growing self-reliance in maritime security.
Iran's Grand Naval Parade showcases its growing capabilities in securing the Persian Gulf waters, a development that signals the dawn of a new era. As regional determination to stand independent of external forces grows, these advancements necessitate a re-evaluation of the presence of foreign powers in the area. Ali Ramezani, Kish Island.
Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus on Sunday afternoon on an urgent visit after the recent developments in the Arab country. He was received at Damascus International Airport by an official delegation.
Throughout Syria's existential struggle against the Zionist entity and terrorism, we have stood side by side with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Today's visit by the Iranian Foreign Minister is part of our ongoing coordination and collaboration during this critical phase, as we are committed to victory alongside our friends, including Russians.
President Bashar al-Assad met with Araghchi and affirmed that the Syrian government, people and army will continue to fight with all firmness and determination to eradicate terrorism and eliminate it. Araghchi conveyed a message from the Iranian leadership confirming Iran's firm support for Syria in its fight against terrorism and its full readiness to provide all types of support, reiterating his country's commitment to the unity and stability of Syria.
This visit of the foreign minister of Iran is the visit in the exact time, and it came to assure to the all, to Syria first, and to all the people who don't trust that Iran is going to be exactly beside Syria in this war against the terrorism. And assure another thing, that this war is a part of the war of the Israelis against all the resistance all over the area, and Iran is going to be the beside of the Syrian people as it was the beside of the Lebanese or Palestinian people.
After his visit to Damascus, Araghchi will go to Ankara to discuss ways to find an acceptable solution to the current situation in Syria as part of Iran's diplomatic efforts. Analysts believe that the current diplomatic movement echoes the military situation on the ground, which will be determined by the Syrian Arab Army and its allies.
While the world remains mute spectator to the resurgence of terrorism in Syria, Araghchi's visit comes at this critical time as part of Iran's diplomatic efforts to resolve the crisis in Syria and to reaffirm Tehran's unwavering support for Damascus. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. From wherever you're listening to us, welcome to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma once more. I have the honor to be at your service as the host, and I have two very dear guests with me, Brother Liaqat and Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Thank you so much. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming here. Well, I already know you, and I guess a lot of our listeners know you as well. But then, just as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself pretty much briefly. Tell us who you are and what's your background.
This is Zainab Askari, and I have studied master's in linguistics, and then I studied Hausa for past 10 years. Took me a lot of time to study Hausa, and also researching in the field of women issues.
So that's very great. And you, Brother Liaqat?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm Muhammad Liaqat Abbas from India, and right now I'm doing my master's in psychology. And of course, with Hausawi background as well, doing my Hausa studies at the same time. And of course, my specialization is in psychology, Islamic psychology, mm-hmm. and history.
That's very great. Thank you. So thank you both of you for being here. I guess like this, we can have a pretty interesting discussion today. Well, living as a human being is very difficult. Like I was reading this somewhere, and it became so important for me to know, really, what's the meaning of success? Like the woman in there, the woman who actually composed that poetry, the gist of her words was that at the end of the day, we're not going to be judged by how much money we have gained, by how much book we have written, by how much houses we have built, by whatever materialistic thing that we have gained, gathered, flourished, accomplished, or whatever. We're not going to be judged by these stuff. At the end of the day, it's the heart that's going to count. At the end of the day, your passion, your kindness toward human beings would count more and more. And then it raised this question in my mind that, okay, really, how do we define success?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. For us, success is just amassing degrees and looking for better career options.
Yeah,
and
getting into PhD. First of all, BA, then MA, then PhD.
Then PhD, like half of our life, more than half of our life. More than half of our life goes in.
Until you get retired.
Yeah. So then we are like in this journey, and it's not like for example, I think age wise it differs. For like example, when I'm in my school days, success seems something to me, like for example, achieving a college degree.
Yeah.
But when I have achieved that college degree,
I'm in college, I don't think
now
that
my success has changed.
Yeah.
Now having PhD in my hand is what matters to me. Then when I have that, then I am looking for a good career option. Then when I have that, I'm looking to make a good house. When I also have that, I still am not satisfied.
Yeah.
And
there's no end to human greed.
Yeah.
In the sense of whatever they dream for.
But it's like I count this as success, but this is not the real success.
Mm-hmm.
For me, real success is when you have found the purpose of your life.
I would say success is different for different people. Just like sister has said, in every single part of our life, the spectrum of life, we have
as much as individuals we have in this world,
exactly.
We have definition of success.
Definitions of success change from person to person. Example, for few people, it's money. For few, it is a degree. That's it. For few, it's like helping others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's the definition completely changes. And
it could
of course,
be anything.
It can be, yeah. And also, I would say religion also plays a very big role over here when we speak about success. And for people who are atheists, example.
Exactly.
Success is different. But for a Hindu, the definition of success might be different. But for a Muslim who is from a different sect, like example, he's a Sunni. Success might be different, but for me as a Shia example, success is completely different.
Yeah, but that's now you just popped it up very interestingly. For an atheist, what would be called success? Like there's no meaning, everything is going to end at a point and then nothing after that.
Exactly.
What is success?
Success, atheists again differ, okay? There are atheists who don't believe in the hereafter, who don't believe in life after death, example, and who are characterless, okay? For those people, success means to gain everything which is materialism. Whatever is materialistic.
Yeah, luxury,
I'm gonna gain, yeah, exactly. All the luxuries, all the pleasures of the world, be it halal or haram, from our perspective, they want it, okay? But for those atheists who are, like I would say, decent, have character, for them, of course, they kind of follow laws. They abide by the laws. They go with the morals, example, okay?
Yeah, morals.
But me as a Shia, example, I would definitely go after the hadith of Rasulullah, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where he says, Ya Ali, you and your Shias are successful on the day of judgment, example. Of course, if we have the wilaya, that is the main success, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Shia, when we speak about Shia, we have to define what is a Shia. Who is a follower? Who is a true follower, example?
Yeah, who's a true follower?
Exactly.
That's a matter of question.
That is... the actual success, according to Rasulullah, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Me as a Shia, I have to see what the Rasul, my prophet, is saying. Example, he brought Amirul Mu'minin into picture. And of course, when Imam comes into picture, there are the 12 infallibles with him, indeed. And following them is definitely obligatory. And through their following to, like, their path, okay, following them, is the real success in this world and the hereafter, indeed. If I'm following them in this world, I'm successful in this world. Actually, this is the beginning of the hereafter, isn't it?
Exactly.
So I'm successful on the day of judgment. Likewise, I'm successful in this world.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
They say life is nothing but dream within dream. And I do believe that, yes, it is true. Human beings, in order to continue their life, in order to come from one day to another day, in order to pass these days and minutes and seconds, they have to have dreams. They have to build some wishes for themselves, some purposes. They have to establish different purposes at different phases of their life because they want to continue. Because who knows where the road is going? Maybe it's going to be a journey of only 1 year, 5 year, 10 years. Who knows? And some people would go up until even 100. They would live up to a century. But then what they really need for this life is a fuel, and that fuel is their wishes, their dreams, and whatever they define as success in their lives. So if I would be a kind of a person who dreams of a better life, who dreams for success as in materialistic things, would you call it a trivial sort of purpose?
Not necessarily. So,
you know what I want to get? What gives my purpose value and worth? What is going to make the way I define success in my life?